Is it not a fact that the more man penetrates into the realm of spirituality, the more he is apartment to lose himself in a tangle of things where words and formal standards of value cease to be a reliable basis, and where everything may be conveniently used as an excuse? The following evening Dolmar and I met for the last time. The day afterwards a party had reached their village. It was not until the parting hour that I fully realized how greatly this beautiful Tibetan girl was devoted to me. She herself may have thought that it was a kind of soul love, but perhaps she was deceiving herself. It was, no doubt, soul love, but soul love with a very pronounced human touch. No matter how much human relationships are on so-called higher levels, there is always a personal touch in them. It may be latent, but is nevertheless very real. There are, no doubt, spiritual people among my readers who profoundly disagree with me in this connection and who stick to the opinion that spiritual contacts must be free from any lower human element. To these readers I should recommend to put to themselves the question whether it would not have mattered at all if Dolmar had been a woman of, say, 70 years of age. There are some women of that age who are still very spiritual and vital, or if Dolmar, the beautiful young girl, had met me in the visible form of a very spiritual and vital old man of the apparent age of 80. The next few days were somewhat uneventful until I reached the Tibetan Tsong in which Narbu, Dolmar's spiritual teacher, lived. I looked forward to my interview with him. After all that Dolmar had told me about him, he appeared not only a highly spiritual person, but also someone entrusted with an important political mission by the occult brotherhood to which he belonged. During the next few days I suffered greatly from lack of water for drinking and washing. There had been no rainfall for many days and everything large house built for powerful people in the district had dried up rapidly. However, an individual accustomed to travel alone in the various deserts of the world easily adapts himself to difficult situations. Even half a pint of water can last over long distances if you merely use it for wetting your parched lips and then put about a cubic inch of water into your mouth, swallowing it very slowly, almost drop by drop. In this way, half a pint of water may keep one going for 2 days. The last afternoon before I reached Narbu's Tsong there was a violent thunderstorm. Something like 2 inches of rain fell in half an hour. Just before the thunderstorm set in, the sky looked indescribably majestic. It was a sight such as can be seen only once in many years in Western countries. The clouds were almost as black as ink and looked as if demons of gigantic proportions were brewing something in a cauldron. Some of the clouds resembled gigantic monsters, and when the torrential downpour started, sheets of lightning followed one another at the rate of about 3 sheets per second. Narbu's Tsong was situated in a comparatively densely inhabited area. I usually avoided the trade routes while I traveled in disguise in Tibet and gave an especially wide berth to places where I had reason to believe that white people had put in an appearance. If my information was correct, the various district governors in Tibet were by then for the most part connected by telephone lines. The Tibetan word Tsong has a double meaning. It means fortress or seat of a district governor. But it also means a private residence inhabited by rich people which, by the way, seems to indicate that the Tibetans do pin a little more faith on those newfangled things imported for long-distance communication from the West than on their sorcerers, who are supposed to be able to send messages on the wind, as the Tibetans put it, that is to say, by telepathy. To have been found at a place serving as a residence to a Tsongkhapan would have been a terrific experience in the Forbidden Country, and it was highly probable that the place in which Narbu resided had been chosen as a place of residence by such an individual. To minimize the risk of detection, I spent the last night a long distance away from the place and then walked 10 miles non-stop early in the morning, intending to arrive at Naobu's residence about an hour and a half after sunrise. Even then I narrowly escaped trouble. When the first houses came in view I sat down for a little while in order to take a few minutes rest before approaching the residence. While I sat there a Tibetan left one of the houses and came up to the place where I was seated on the ground. He eyed me suspiciously as if he had been the Tibetan equivalent of a plainclothes man and then asked in a none too friendly way, "Shile Irudunash runt dadai?" I answered in as natural a way as possible, a slight touch in my voice denoting a mild degree of annoyance at being disturbed. "G District Governor, F what are you doing here?" "Dollar, I sit here to watch." There was nothing particular to be watched. The man and Seymour eyed me suspiciously and went away. But when I arrived at Nabu's house a few minutes later I noticed that he had shadowed me. Police methods are frightfully primitive in Tibet. When he saw that I handed a letter to a servant of so respectable and powerful a man he seemed to be reassured and walked away. The glammy looked at my cheap chupa in a none too respectful way. The humbler the position of a man in life the more he is inclined to value a man by such utilities as dress and similar trifles, and Tibet does not seem to be different from the West in this respect. He told me that he would hand the letter to His Excellency, but when I said I had to wait for an answer he turned a deaf ear to my request and went away. I waited patiently for half an hour, a wait which was not very pleasant, since some of the passers-by seemed to eye me rather curiously while I stood there in my poor clothes before the main entrance of the rich man's dasong. Suddenly a man of about 50 years of age, dressed in pure silk, came out of the house. He at once apologized in a very courteous and apparently sincere manner for having kept me waiting. "Dolma's letter," he explained, "had only been handed to him a few minutes before and he had severely reprimanded the servant for having taken things so leisurely. The Tibetan Excellency, who seemed to be a perfect gentleman, then led me upstairs, servant gown dot to the amazement of the servant who had taken my letter. The floors were covered with costly gowns and everything in the house seemed to be well appointed and very clean. Dolma has written a very long jaij, why?" said Naobu, while we walked together to the room where breakfast was served. "She is a clever girl and seldom makes a mistake in judging people. She writes that you seem to be a man who possesses a very independent outlook on spiritual matters and is a determined truth seeker. I always liked such people. Dolma also writes that you have traveled very much and that she has some difficulty to believe that you are Tibetan or Ladakhi at all. Would you not make a clean breast of it? Neither Dolma nor I ever betray anyone. You have my word of honor that nothing whatsoever which you may entrust to me will ever leak out." I looked at him and was more and more impressed by his unostentatious attitude and sincere manner. A servant entered the room, bringing various kinds of food. It was the first time during my travels in Tibet that I had something almost amounting to what may be called an opulent breakfast. I even got spaghri from India and other things which are considered great delicacies by the Tibetans. The servant left the room, and Naobu once more told me that it would be better for all concerned if I did not hide from him anything. "I shall tell you the truth," I said, "but your carpets. F letter dot excellency will be greatly and perhaps unpleasantly surprised." "Drop the excellency," he said smilingly. "Dolma's friends are my own, and spiritual ties remove all considerations of rank. Let us be friends." The servant returned with more food. As soon as he opened the door we began to talk about meaningless things, Naobu asking whether I had heard any interesting things on my travels. I answered that I had seen and heard very much during the last few weeks. Suddenly the servant almost opened his mouth with amazement. "What was the matter?" I realized that I had committed the dreadful crime of using the words Mthnanthos in answering His Excellency, instead of employing the more polite and ceremonial words Gigs and Gshan / which mean exactly the same thing. The servant looked greatly puzzled. Narabu asked him whether he had something else to attend to in the room, and when the Glammy / answered in the negative, Narabu ordered him to put tea and teacups in the study and then to join the Asna / and not to return before the time had come for the next meal. We went to Narabu's study, and when we had sat down I broke the news to him that I was a Westerner traveling in disguise. I had my suspicions the moment I saw you, he replied smilingly, but you played your part seen and heard. The chief cook of his household. F servant. Remarkably well. Unless people's attention is specially drawn to you, I doubt whether even educated Tibetans would find you out. I have decided to turn deaf and dumb every time I meet lamas or educated people, I told him. That is a very wise course to take, he observed. Do not feel uncomfortable because I told you that I had felt the un-Tibetan atmosphere about you. I have traveled extensively, both on private business and on behalf of my friends in the valley. I have been to India, China, Japan, and Pilinpa. We may speak English if you like. The lengthy conversations which followed were in English until we took our next meal, during which we were attended by two servants. Narabu had a fairly good knowledge of English. Our talk drifted to the subject of politics and the various great powers. Narabu seemed to have excellent, although in some respects a little stale, information about the currents underlying the various visible political trends of our time. We soon felt that our conversation was of the greatest mutual benefit. He once more assured me that neither he nor Dolma would ever betray me and that I should communicate with him immediately in case I got into trouble. My arms are very long in this country, he added smilingly. Again he casually mentioned the valley. While we talked about other matters, he again and again mentioned a valley in Tibet where many highly evolved spiritual people lived with whom was in close contact. When he mentioned it for the fourth time, I took this for an invitation to ask him something about it. I then learned that the Valley of Mystery was the headquarters of a powerful occult fraternity of which Narabu was a member. Dolma had never visited it. Are you interested in such things? He asked me bluntly, since I maintained a certain reserve every time he began to go more fully into the matter. Yes, I answered, I am interested in all spiritual matters, but I never join any sect or association whatsoever. Why? He asked. Because I wish to maintain absolute independence, I answered. In a fraternity the freedom of the members is always respected, he observed. Spiritual freedom is our guiding principle. Have you a chief? I asked. Yes. He is very great, perhaps the greatest power on earth. But our members obey him voluntarily. Why is it called the Valley of Mystery? I asked. This is the name given to it by the multitude, he answered. No one except our members and occasional guests are admitted to the valley. And the population does not know much about it and people who live in the same district even abstain from talking about it. That is why it is commonly called the Valley of Mystery. How about the guests who occasionally visit the valley? I asked. By whom are they invited? The members who hold a somewhat higher position in the occult hierarchy may invite guests, but then they are entirely and personally responsible for them. I happen to be such a member, stated Narabu. What obligations must a guest enter into before he is allowed to visit the valley? I asked him. None at all. Until he joins the fraternity he is under no obligation at all. But what qualifies a man to be chosen as such a guest? A sincere and wholehearted desire for salvation, said Narabu. Do you think I am such a man? I think you are. If you care to come, I shall invite you on my own responsibility. Then and there he fetched a rough sketch map of Tibet. The only obligation for you, he said, while he put the map on the carpet before us, is an undertaking that you will not reveal its exact location. I promised this and he immediately showed me on the map the location of their valley. I propose that you should leave early tomorrow morning. I shall give instructions to one of my servants to accompany you until the evening so that you may get away from this district, where all strangers are regarded with some suspicion. I shall also give you a letter stating that you are a member of my household. If you are annoyed by officials or lamas, show them the letter. Naboo drank the contents of another cup of tea. During the last half hour he had gulped down the contents of one cup after another at the rate of one cup every 5 minutes, and good-sized cups they were too. He added sugar every time. Only very rich Tibetans can afford such a thing. Since sugar is expensive in comparison with the income of the Tibetan multitude, the Tibetans in the humble walks of life do not add sugar to their tea. Even in the rare occasions when they do not mix it with butter and barley meal, they do not dissolve the sugar in the tea but merely touch it from time to time with the tip of their tongue, washing down the liquid at intervals. This is the 9th cup since you came here, observed Naboo. Has it ever occurred to you that 9 is a very auspicious number? I have studied the various occult philosophies, I answered, and have my own views on numerology which are the result of much independent thinking. I do not hold the view that 9 is an auspicious number. Why? I think man ought not to carry numerological speculations beyond the figure 5, I answered. Why that, 5 is the number of man. The higher numbers lead to complication and perdition, the smaller ones to God. But surely the number 9 exists, aye it does, because the conventional system of counting runs up to 9, and then 10 quite arbitrarily becomes the higher unit. We could just as well adopt a system in which we should have only 4 figures, namely 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 being equivalent to the higher unit. Then 9 would not exist, nor would 6, 7 and 8, which in my opinion, arithmosophically, are all numbers of complication, entanglement, and seduction. What an original idea! Exclaimed Naboo. I have studied numerology for several years. Its occult bearing is enormous. Figures have an occult connection with abstract notions with which we correlate them. In this way, figures can be made a kind of medium between the divine and man. Numerology is a highly double-edged affair, I observed, although it looks quite harmless. Suppose we get down to concrete numerological notions, said Naboo. Although you seem to be reluctant to indulge in numerological abstractions beyond the figure 5, perhaps you will have no objection to our taking up 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5. Take 1. 1 is the number of oneness, the number of non-manifested divinity. I think you must agree to this. Yes, I observed, I do. If we imagine a point in space, it is a mere abstraction, for a point really is immaterial. So 1 is the number of undivided abstract existence. I am surprised that you introduce geometrical notions into the field of numerology. It is a very original idea, observed Naboo. No, let us take the philosophy of abstract figures. F. The following conversation on numerology has a connection with some of the observations made by the author in the mysterious underground city of the initiates described later in the book. The figure 2. It represents the contrast between spirit and matter. I profoundly disagree with you here, I said. Do you deny that 2 is the number of contrasts? Asked Naboo, greatly surprised. I agree that 2 is the number of contrasts, I answered, but not the contrast you have just mentioned. If we take 2 points in space, they determine the position of a straight line, which also is immaterial. But it remains to be seen what abstract contrast is reflected by the figure 2. Why, oh, you say it is the one between spirit and matter. In my opinion, you are wrong. Spirit is an abstraction, but matter is not, so the abstract line represented by figure 2, which connects 2 points, each of which is immaterial, really is the contrast between 2 different kinds of spirit and not between spirit and matter. Naabu remained silent for a while and then he said, you seem to be right, but this never occurred to me. More and more I feel how useful you would be to us in the secret city in the Valley of Mystery. For the first time he had mentioned a secret city. There must be 2 altogether different types of spirituality which are diametrically opposed to each other, I continued. That, in my opinion, is the numerological significance of the figure 2. We then discussed 3 and 4, and agreed that 3 was the dynamic number par excellence and 4 the number of matter. 3 points scattered in space determine the position of a triangle, I observed, but only 4 abstract points lay down the outline of a geometrical form having corporeal existence. With 3 therefore we leave the realm of the abstract and with 4 we enter the domain of the concrete. 4 is the number of the visible universe, the number of matter. We have not yet reached the dangerous figures, said Naabu smilingly. If we imagine 5 points scattered in space, I went on, and call them A, B, C, D and E, we may envisage A, B, C and D only and obtain a geometrical form. But we may also link up A, B, C and E, and obtain another geometrical form. In fact, we can obtain 5 different combinations, namely, ABCD, ABCE, ABDE, ICDE and BCDE. 5 therefore represents the interpenetration of 5 different spaces. With 5 the creature has reached the very limits of its existence. 5 is the number of the creature and the number of manifested life which seems to exist simultaneously on 5 planes. Man lives, if I may say so, in 5 different realms, viz., the physical one and those of sensation, feeling, intelligence, and will. These are 5 realms which interpenetrate each other. If you imagine 6 points scattered in space, I went on, a synthetical geometrical conception of the various connections between the 6 points is obviously beyond the reach of man. As I said before, the figures exceeding 5, viewed numerologically, have a dissociating effect on the personality of man. They are numbers of perdition. Naabu was in deep thought. You have taught me much during these few minutes, he observed after a while. It is good sometimes to hear about conceptions which are very different from the ones to which we are accustomed. By the way, can you give me a short definition of what matter really is? Matter, I replied, may be regarded as the battleground on which 2 different types of spirituality fight each other. That is where we disagree again, observed Naabu. I always thought that there was only 1 type of spirituality. I think this is a question to be decided by experience rather than by argument, I said. We shall discuss this further in the secret city, observed Naabu. For the second time he had hinted at the existence of a secret city. He proceeded to show me the various parts of his house. He also had a large garden which must have been quite an extraordinary thing in the district, since parks and gardens are but seldom to be found in Tibet outside the Lhasa district. He was very friendly, and said that he greatly appreciated my company. I felt that he was absolutely sincere, and that he did not act in any way. A servant came up to him announcing 2 visitors of rank, and went away to show them into a kind of elegantly furnished reception room. "It will perhaps be better for you not to talk to them," observed Naobu. "I suggest that you wait for me here, and if my absence becomes lengthy you may go up to my study, to the library, or to the garden." His Excellency smiled and went to the reception room. A high Tibetan official passed me a few seconds later, led by a servant and accompanied by a Tibetan officer. When he saw my cheap chupa he eyed me with obvious contempt, as he did not know, of course, that I was Naobu's guest. But when the door of the reception room was opened by another servant, his attitude of haughty arrogance suddenly gave way to toad-like obsequiousness as he greeted Naobu, who had come to the threshold to meet him. When the visitors had left, Naobu joined me immediately, and soon afterwards a substantial meal was served, including such delicacies as potatoes, rice and apples, which are practically never eaten by the Tibetan multitude because they are much too expensive. Again and again another servant brought a silver dish containing tepid water for washing our fingers. After dinner we went to the library. Although most books were Tibetan, of course, there were quite a few English books in it, including fairly recent works on occultism and political and sociological questions. "Is there also a library in the Valley of Mystery?" I asked him. "Yes," he replied, "but it is only accessible to the members of the fraternity. You are going there as my guest, on my full and personal responsibility, but guests are not allowed to visit the library of the Forbidden City unless they obtain special gown. Permission which only the chief of the occult hierarchy, whom we reverently call the Prince of Light, can grant." Naobu drew a sketch and then handed it to me, saying, "This sketch shows you the best way to reach the valley. Will you permit me to add some money for your expenses during the journey?" He took a bundle of new Tibetan banknotes and a handful of silver coins out of a drawer. "No," I said, "it is very kind of you, but I travel alone and meet brigands from time to time. It is of no use for me to take so much money along, as it would almost certainly be taken away on the next occasion I meet them. I still have some coins which are carefully hidden in my shoes. I cannot take more, I am sorry," said Naobu, "but I notice your shoes are no longer in good condition. If you permit me to loan you a new and comfortable pair of leather shoes and a new chupa, I should be very, very pleased." I then spent the larger part of the afternoon in the library. After the substantial evening meal served by three servants and another walk in the garden, Naobu led me to one of the guest rooms situated on the first floor. I then spent a few hours in repairing my equipment and tried to fall asleep a couple of hours after sunset, which is a very difficult matter for about 10 years past the Tibetan government has issued banknotes which, however, are currency only in the less isolated districts of the country. In the inhabited part of Tibet, since most Tibetans show just as little consideration for people who may want to fall asleep as the inhabitants of some parts of the continent of Europe. Since Naobu's song was surrounded by many Tibetan houses, the various noises went on unabated until late at night. At 5 o'clock in the morning, kind-hearted and hospitable Naobu rose personally to see to it that I was properly attended to by the servants, and after an early breakfast taken in the company of my host, I left his song accompanied by one of his trusted servants, who had instructions to accompany me until I had left the inhabited district. Before I left, Naobu told me that he would leave his house for the Valley of Mystery on horseback a day or two later, and he handed me a letter of introduction. He added that he had already sent a message announcing my arrival to the City of the Initiates by a messenger on horseback, who had left the Dzong the previous day. After Naobu's servant had left me to return to the Dzong of his master, I had only one experience worth recording before I reached the Valley of Mystery. The following day I came across a group of Tibetan ascetics who believed that it was possible to attain spiritual results by fasting and other exercises having a direct influence on the body. Their belief was briefly as follows: man is both spirit and matter. Spirit is immanent. It is immovable and divine by its very essence. So all man has to do is to attend to the channel through which spirit manifests itself, namely his body, and thus the flow of spirit will pass through it without hindrance and man will become automatically spiritualized.